You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming.
Wallawani Nindawan, Nayaka Kiran, and this is Yilliman on 3CR. 855M on your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. You can also listen in on demand via Spotify and Apple Music and wherever else you might get your podcast. Going to start off today's episode with a few announcements of some upcoming events. Now, this first one isn't for the local listeners, sorry, it's for our interstate listeners, especially those up in Gadigal or, you know, Sydney as it's now known by its colonial name. This Friday, October the 3rd, from 6 p.m. at the Flight Path Theatre in Marrickville, there is a event, it's called Defeating Spectacle and Illusion. It's been put on by a group called The Breath of Revolutions. It's also a podcast. I'm going to be on the panel there alongside some other comrades, talking a bit about the way that liberalism has really impacted our organising spaces. So if you are up in Gadigal this Friday, please do pop along to that one. There's also going to be a bunch of zines, some good shirts and whatever else, other merch for sale, with the proceeds going towards the Palestinian Cultural Club in Lebanon. They're going to have a bunch of DJs and other artists and stuff as well after the panel, as well as be putting on a feed there. So yeah, if you're up in Gadigal, do come along to that one this Friday. Later on in the month, I mentioned this last week, I'll mention it again as we get closer as well, but we have the zine fair that IRL, or the Incendium Radical Library, are hosting. The BPU will be there alongside many other organisations and comrades with a whole range of zines on different topics. Now, that one is going to be held at Edinburgh Garden on Saturday the 25th of October from 2 to 5pm. Do come along to that one as well. There's going to be a lot of great educational resources available for people to pick up. No doubt there'll be other stuff there as well, like some merch and stickers and whatever else. And it's a good opportunity to get your hands on some, you know, really great educational resources on a bunch of different political subjects and topics. Back to Gadigal again. When is it? It's next week on October the 8th at 7 p.m. Professor Alana Lenton from the University of Western Sydney, is doing a book launch for her new book, The New Racial Regime. Professor Lenton is a Jewish woman and a professor who teaches quite a lot about stuff like racism and society. She's been putting out works around this issue for many years. Now, that launch is going to be at 7 p.m. as I mentioned just before, and it's going to start off with a bit of a panel as well with a range of different speakers. I'm going to be on that one as well, alongside Kaya, who's an Afro-Indigenous writer and scholar, I haven't met this person, so, you know, apologies if I mispronounce the name, but I think the name is Shauna Tang. They're a lecturer in the Department of Gender and Cultural Studies, also at University of Western Sydney, and Alana, of course. So, you know, if you're up in Gadigal, do come along to that one as well next week. That's October the 8th. Later on in the month, and again I'll mention this as we get closer, back down here in Naam, on October the 19th, I believe, there is a counter-protest that has been called against another one of these white nationalist fascist protests that has been organised by the NSN and their related bodies, or, you know, whatever you want to call them, their affiliates. But that counter-protest is going to kick off at the front of State Library of Victoria on Sunday, October the 19th at 11 a.m. Come along to that one. That one's been organised by quite a large united front of different organisations down here, including, you know, the BPU, as well as people from the Wurundjeri community, There's going to be, you know, it's been organised, sorry, by, you know, people from like SALT and CARV, as well as the other socialist organisations. A bunch of the different diaspora groups as well, like the African Solidarity Collective and LASNET, and a whole bunch of others. So yeah, it's a good show of unity, that one. So do come along to that one as well, so that we can let these Nazis and fascists and racists know that they aren't welcome here on the streets of this city, and that whenever they organise, we will show up en masse to confront them and to restrict them from being able to march and hold their little demonstrations in this city where they're not welcome. On today's show, we're going to be talking a bit about liberalism again. Now, you know I often bring up this subject and I often speak about this on the show, but that's because it's so relevant. It is such an important topic to cover, and it's a very large topic to cover as well. It is so relevant because, you know, it's not something that is abstract or distant, but it's very much the political and social framework that defines the everyday life here in so-called Australia. Now, when people hear liberal or liberalism, you know, there's a few things that they might think about, or a few things that might come to mind. You know, first and foremost, of course, there's the Liberal National Party. We're not talking about the Liberal Party, although they definitely do fall in the confines of liberalism. You know, if you're a bit more of a conservative leaning, which is unlikely if you're listening to this show, but, you know, if you are, or if you know people in your life that are, you know, when you talk about liberalism to them, they might associate liberalism with, you know, so-called woke culture or with a more progressive outlook. It's not. If you're somebody who leans left, which I would assume you are if you're a regular listener of this show, if you're somebody who leans left, or, you know, identifies as some sort of communist or Marxist or socialist or anarchist or progressive or whatever else, you know, you might view liberalism as either a good thing or a bad thing, depending where you fit on the spectrum. You know, you might view it as a ideology that you identify with, or you might be very critical of it. But today we're going to talk a bit about, like, you know, the overarching formation of liberalism and the form that it takes within society. So, you know, when people hear about this, they might often also think of, like, personal freedoms, for example. But, you know, liberalism is much more than that. What liberalism actually is the dominant political theory of the modern world. It is the foundation of the colonial system of this continent as well. You know, the political ideology that not only founded the colonization of this continent, but very much justified it. Pardon me. Very much justified it, and continues to day to justify imperialism and capitalism and the colonial occupation here, but we'll get onto that. You know, it's something that has been quite often presented as well as the, you know, so-called common sense of politics. You know, and when I say that, I'm talking about, like, the way that liberalism frames, you know, a commitment to so-called freedom and equality and progress. But, you know, when we actually look closer, when we actually view what liberalism is, we see that those values are always defined in ways that serve the powerful and preserve the system as it currently stands, the capital colonial system, that is. Now, liberalism is the language of rights, apparently. You know, it very much talks about personal freedoms and whatever else, but it's a lot more than that as well. I suppose the best way to explain it is liberalism can be viewed on three different levels. It can be viewed as a political theory. It can be viewed through the way that it is the primary structure of the colonial governance of this continent and colonial government here. And it can also be viewed very much on an interpersonal level in the way that we interact with each other and the relationships we have with each other, as well as the way that we act, just generally speaking. Now, on that last note, you know, Mao Zedong is somebody who very much talked about that in his work, Combat Liberalism. But if you are somebody who might identify as a Marxist or a communist, I've heard this quite a lot from a lot of, you know, settler communists here. You know, a lot of settler communists don't view the liberalism that Mao spoke about as actually being liberalism. Now, they view liberalism as this political theory, but that whole analysis actually misses the way that liberalism manifests on an individual level. And in fact, you know, I'm just going to be blunt here. You know, most of the settlers on this continent who do identify on the left, whether it be communist or anarchist or socialist or whatever, most of them completely miss entire segments of their analysis of liberalism. You know, they don't actually fully understand it, and they view it as something that is very abstract and, you know, very based in theory and books and whatever else. But as a result, they completely miss what it actually is and the way that it manifests. And I think that, you know, Mao really hit the nail on the head when he produced that pamphlet, Combat Liberalism, and spoke of, you know, I think there was 11 forms of liberalism he spoke about there. But, you know, he really hit the nail on the head because, you know, a lot of these people, they don't understand what liberalism actually is, these settlers here. And, you know, to be fair to them, the reason for that is because they were raised in a liberal society, in a liberal culture, with liberal norms and values and ethics and whatever else. You know, it's just basic sociology 101. If you're raised in a society, you're obviously going to embody the values and the ethics and outlooks of that society. So if you're raised in a liberal society, which these people are, they're obviously going to view society through that liberal lens. And as a result, you know, they're not able to actually take a step back and have a look at the full picture. Now, you know, one of the arguments I hear against this is that there is a political spectrum within Western societies and within, you know, so-called Australia in particular. But that spectrum doesn't mean that liberalism doesn't exist. In fact, you know, or that it isn't as impactful as it is. In fact, you know, that spectrum is a spectrum that exists within the confines of liberalism itself. And in fact, that spectrum just further serves to entrench liberalism in our society because it gives this whole false facade of there being nuance and of there being options and of there being variation and whatever else. But at the end of the day, practically all settler political theories and outlooks and values and ethics and whatever else exist within that spectrum of liberalism. You know, it's something that a lot of settlers don't want to reconcile with either and don't want to acknowledge or accept. You know, when we talk about fascism, for example, you know, fascism exists on the spectrum of liberalism, you know, albeit a far right version of it, but it still exists on that very limited and constricted spectrum of liberalism. And then when we come back to the other side and we look at European notions of communism, again, that exists within the spectrum of liberalism. Now, you know, quite a lot of these settler communists and socialists and Marxists and whatever else, you know, they like to view themselves as being separate from liberal ideology and of being critiques of it and whatever else, you know, critics of it, sorry, and whatever else. But at the end of the day, you know, Marx himself was somebody who was raised in a liberal society with liberal values and ethics and a liberal outlook. And as a result, you know, quite a lot of his theory exists within that spectrum of liberalism. And, you know, it's true. Like, people might try and deny it and people might, you know, think that it's not true and whatever else, but they're coming from a Eurocentric outlook when they do. You know, their analysis is unable to properly capture their circumstances because they exist within those circumstances. You know, they can't take a step back and see the full picture. But, you know, when we look at Marx, for example, and we look at quite a lot of his writings, quite a lot of it is based in people like John Locke, who was, you know, one of the fathers of liberalism, is based in John Locke's own outlooks. I mean, you know, it was John Locke himself who first put forward this whole notion of, well, in the European world anyways, but this whole notion of, you know, if you mix your blood and sweat with the soil, then you have a claim over those means of production. You know, and then when we look at Marx, it's very much the same thing. You know, the workers should rightfully own the means of production. But, you know, this is, again, it all stems from that same political ideology and that same thought process. It's just different versions of it at the end of the day. But, you know, there's quite a lot of other things. You know, Marx, for example, in his writings on India, very much, what's the word I'm looking for here? He very much supported the, you know, don't get me wrong, he was critical of it, but he very much also supported the colonization and the occupation of India by Britain, because he saw it as a way for the people of India to progress towards communism. You know, that's very much a liberal thinking. You know, it bases the whole... I'll tell you why it's liberal thinking, because, you know, it bases the whole outlook of society and the whole outlook of what we define as progress and, you know, the hurdles and markers and whatever else that people have to meet to, you know, be accepted as having progress and whatever else. It bases it all within the outlook of a Eurocentric mindset where development is modernity and modernity is development, to phrase Luazi Lashuba, who is somebody who actually speaks quite a lot about the Eurocentricities of liberalism and the way that liberalism and Eurocentric mindsets are very much tied into each other. I do actually recommend you go and read that book if you haven't. It's called Modernity as Development, Development as Modernity. It's got a, you know, you can find free PDFs of it on Google and stuff. But, you know, it's very a very good outlook. And something else as well, you know, to give people another resource, I suppose, to go and look at to understand a bit more what I'm talking about here. Actually, a few episodes back, or actually maybe even last year now, or earlier in the year, but I played a podcast from The Colonized Buffalo where he interviewed Robert Beale. Now, Robert Beale wrote a book, I think it's called The Eurocentricity of Communism, or it's something very similar to that anyways. If you Google it, I'm sure you'll be able to find it pretty easily, and I'm sure there'll be free PDFs online somewhere if you can't access, that if you, you know, financially obstructed from otherwise accessing that text. But, you know, it talks very much about the way that, you know, even communism is still based in liberal thought, still has its origins in liberal thought, and is still very much viewed, at least in the Western world, is still very much viewed through this Eurocentric lens and this Eurocentric mindset. Now, you know, these are things that we really have to reconcile with and really have to acknowledge and start to combat if we're ever going to see actual true progress and, you know, revolutionary progress here in this colony as well as across the broader Western world. Now, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of Marxists and communists and whatever else who are listening to me right now who are, you know, probably screaming at their radio about, like, you know, oh, but what about XYZ, rah, rah, rah. Just go and read the text, you know, because at the end of the day, like, what I'm talking about is I'm not just, you know, talking out of my hole. I'm actually very much based on theory and very much based on a lot of analysis from the global south. Now, you know, I can almost hear you screaming through the radio, you know, what about the people of color from the global south who have used communism to liberate themselves? Yes, they have, but they didn't use a Eurocentric version of communism. You know, they took communism, they took Marxist teachings, and they applied them to their own material circumstances, and they very much built on them to be able to properly apply them to their own material circumstances. And, you know, that is what dialectic materialism is. It's taking the theory and it's applying it to your own circumstances and building on it. You can't just apply Eurocentric Marxism verbatim to any struggle and expect it to have a positive outcome. It won't. You know, it has to be molded and has to be, you know, bent and warped and reapplied to be able to meet the local conditions that it's being reapplied within. You know, that's why we have Maoism, for example. You know, people like Mao who took Marxism but then built on it to apply it to his own local circumstances. You know, that's why we have all of these great African leaders of the past century who have been able to do, you know, wonderful things and contribute so much to the theory. You know, people like Thomas Sankara, people like, you know, Luazi Lashuba, who I mentioned before, people like Kwame Nkrumah, and, you know, there's so many other people. All of them, I'm not going to name them all because there's so many, but, you know, all of them applied Marxism to their own material circumstances, and they built on it because they knew that as it currently stood, It was Eurocentric and it could not be applied verbatim to their material struggle. Now, this is something that quite a lot of the, well, in fact, nearly all of the settler communists and Marxists and whatever else here in this colony refuse to acknowledge and refuse to reconcile with. You know, they try and apply some version of Marxism, whether it be, you know, Marxism or Marx and Leninism or, you know, Trotskyism or whatever else ism. They try and apply those Eurocentric frameworks to a colony. And it doesn't work that way. In fact, you know, if you actually go and read the works of these people, like Lenin, like Trotsky, like Marx, like, you know, whoever else, you will find that they themselves even say that their theory cannot be applied verbatim to any struggle, that instead people need to build on the theory for their own local material conditions. Now, this is something that these people, these settlers, refuse to do. And it's because they're coming from a liberal framework. It's because they are raised in liberalism and they, consciously or not, they identify with liberal politics. You know, that is something that really needs to be combated in society. You know, that's why I'm talking about it today, because it's the primary obstacle. And in fact, you know, even people like MLK, you go and read his letter from Birmingham jail. Again, you can find this for free online if you Google it or whatever other search engine you decide to use. You can find free copies of it online to read. It's not very long. It's only, I think, maybe 2 pages or 3 pages or something like that. But he talks a lot about this in his letter from Birmingham jail, how the primary obstacle for the liberation of black people in the United States at the time, and this is still true today, is not actually the white conservative. You know, it's not the racist politician, it's not the Ku Klux Klaner, it is the white progressive. The white liberal progressive who subscribes to these liberal understandings and liberal ideologies and who tries to control the revolutionary thought and the radical outburst and the self-defense of black people. You know, that black people are undertaking, I should say. It's, you know, again, this was written like 60 years ago or something as well. But it is as relevant back then as it is today. And it's as relevant to the United States as it is to right here in Australia. You know, I've been organizing for over a decade now. And, you know, I can confidently say that, again, for me, in my personal experience, organizing in all sorts of environments as well, you know, with all sorts of different organizations and groups and at, you know, all different levels of colonial government and whatever else, I can confidently say that the biggest obstacle I've ever come up against is these settlers who would identify themselves as a communist or an anarchist or a socialist or, you know, some other, you know, left, so-called left-wing progressive. They are. You have been. You know, these people have been the primary obstacle to everything I've done. It hasn't been the NSN that's the primary obstacle. You know, it's not the Liberal National Party that's the primary obstacle, or Pauline Hanson's One Nation, or, you know, some other far-right group. The primary obstacle has always been so-called settler progressives, and to a lesser extent, the, to paraphrase Uncle Robbie, you know, the tokenuts. That's the First Nations people who, you know, uphold these settler forts and barrack for the settler and do their dirty work for them. You know, they have been the primary obstacle to practically all of the organizing I've ever done. And there's a reason for that. It's because of liberalism. It's because of the way that liberalism impacts people's minds. It impacts their worldviews and their ethics and their values and what they strive for and what they think is possible, and, you know, this, all of these other constraints. And that is why I also bang on about it so much on this radio show. It's because it's so important, it's so relevant. You know, we have to really reconcile with this. We have to understand it, and we have to acknowledge it, and we have to, you know, to quote Mao, we have to start to combat it. We have to combat liberalism. Until we do, we're not going to be able to progress anywhere. we're not going to see any equality or any better circumstances for mob or for the general working class here, whether they be mob or settlers. You know, until we start to combat liberalism, we're not going to see our deaths in custody or over-incarceration rates beginning to fall. We're not going to see an end to the mass kidnapping of one in four of our children. We're not going to see an end to the massive homelessness rates that mob are impacted by, or the massive homelessness rates that other demographics, settler demographics, you know, here on this continent are impacted by. We're not going to see an end to the exploitation of the working class, or the theft of First Nations natural resources. We're not going to see an end to any of those things, so long as people continue to view the world through a liberal framework and a liberal mindset, and through all of these liberal values and ethics that they were moulded by within the society that they were raised within. You know, it's also why I've begun writing this book on liberalism. You know, one of the first books I wanted to write was actually a book on decolonial theory. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm going to get to that book eventually. But people weren't ready for that book. You know, that's why I've chosen instead to write a book about liberalism first. Because to do it the other way around is to, you know, as they say, put the cart before the horse instead of the horse before the cart. You know, I can't talk about decolonial theory and have people ready and willing to accept that and to act on that and to, you know, push that forward so long as they still think like liberals and so long as they still subscribe to liberal values and ethics and politics. You know, that's why, pardon me, that's why, you know, first and foremost, I decided instead to write a book about liberalism first so that people can actually start to combat and confront that liberalism that they have so ingrained within them and within their mindsets and their epistemologies and ontologies and other worldviews before they can start to work towards a decolonial future. Yeah, so yeah, that's why I've written that book first. Hoping to have that book done, you know, within the next month or so. I was originally hoping to have at least the first draft ready to go for the zine fair, but look, I'm going to instead take a little bit more time with it. I want to make sure I get it right. You know, I don't want to just rush it and do a sloppy job. I want to make sure it's a good, solid job. You know, hopefully, though, it'll be... Well, I reckon it will be anyways. It'll be ready to go by Christmas. So, you know, a great Christmas gift for yourself or for your friends and families and comrades and whatever else. So, yeah, do stay tuned for the release of that book. I'm going to go to another song, and when I come back, I'm going to continue to critique liberalism.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
So, yeah, as I said just before, that song by Emily Waramurra, you know, both of these songs that I just played talk about the environmental destruction of our mother country by settlers and settler colonialism and capitalism and, you know, the current forces at play. Now, you know, this is very much tied to liberalism. In fact, it was liberalism that first justified the colonization of this continent, as well as, you know, Africa and Turtle Island and Abya-Yala, or South America as it's otherwise known, as well as, you know, all these other places right across Asia and the Pacific Ocean and wherever else in the world. You know, liberalism has been a key driving force of this colonization that has happened and continues today to be a key driving force of Western imperialism and capitalism. Now, part of the reason I wanted to mention this as well is not just the way that liberalism is a driving force for these things, but the way that liberalism very much influences, you know, these so-called progressives amongst the settler population, very much influences the continued destruction of our country as well as, you know, other countries and nations right around the world. Now, it does this through its whole subscription to the notion that, you know, as I mentioned earlier as well, you know, that whole modernity as development and development as modernity. In particular, the way that we, within Western liberal societies, you know, I say we more generally, not talking about myself or other mob, but, you know, we more generally in Western liberal societies view progress as something that is, you know, marked by institutions and heavy industry and, you know, mining and buildings and, you know, all of these other things within society that have an absolutely devastating impact on the earth. Now, this is especially, it's especially prevalent right across the political spectrum, but this is also prevalent amongst your so-called communists and anarchists and socialists and whoever else. You know, people who very much view societal progress as something that is, you know, earmarked by, you know, the construction of different infrastructure and industry and services and whatever else, without taking into account the impact that these infrastructure and construction actually has on the Mother Earth. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not some anarcho-primitivist who believes we should just go back to all living in bark humpies in the bush and living off the land with no technology whatsoever. I'm not saying that. I don't subscribe to that. You know, as I've spoken about many times on this show in the past, even before colonization, Blackfellas had various forms of heavy industry, whether it be a seafood industry that actually harvested more seafood than Australia does today, or whether it be the massive, you know, mines, for example, up in Queensland that existed pre-colonization as the largest mining operations in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, whether it be the extensive aqua food industry in places like Budge Bim, or, you know, the massive agricultural plots that existed right across the eastern half of this continent. You know, there was many ways in which Blackfellas pre-colonization utilized heavy industry and infrastructure and whatever else. But it was done in a very different way to the way that settlers like to do that today. And in fact, you know, a liberal value that is very much held by the settler communists and socialists and whatever else is this whole idea that if they had a successful revolution tomorrow, that they could somehow manage Australia's ecological collapse so that it wouldn't happen. And, you know, they could somehow mitigate climate change and, you know, they could stop all the topsoil erosion and all the dryland salinity and the massive deforestation rates and extinction rates and whatever else that we have here on this continent. You know, some of the worst ecological catastrophes in the last 150 years have happened here on this continent and are continuing to happen today. And the fact of the matter is, settlers, especially, you know, your settler communists and socialists and whatever else, they would be powerless to stop this ecological destruction. Simply because of two things, you know, first and foremost, unlike Blackfellas, they don't possess 60,000 plus years of cultural knowledge around the environment and the ecology and the sustainability and, you know, the management of this continent like Blackfellas do, but also because of this liberal way that they view development, especially in the Western sense, as being an earmark of progress and of being something that defines progress and, you know, goes hand in hand with progress. That is, you know, another way that liberalism manifests in these left-wing settler progressive spaces. They believe that, you know, in order to be a great progressive society, they need to go and create these mines in such a way that they destroy the environment, so that they can get a whole bunch of steel and whatever else, so that they can build, you know, a big public transport infrastructure, for example. Now, you know, I'm not against public transport. Again, you know, I'm not saying I'm against development, but the way that it would be undertaken by settlers is not a way that is sustainable and is not a way that is at harmony with the Mother Earth. Now, you know, that's not to say that, you know, that's not to say that we shouldn't have any progress at all. As I mentioned just before, you know, we should have development and progress, of course, and we should be able to provide infrastructure to the population. But we know that the way that it would be undertaken by settlers is not a way that would mitigate all of these ecological concerns that we currently have. It's because, you know, of those two things I mentioned just before, because they're lacking the knowledge and because their outlook prioritizes development over sustainability. You know, it's as simple as that, really, at the end of the day. And there have been many cases right around the world that show us that communists are still incapable of environmentally sustainable development. Now, these cases especially are prominent in in European and Western nations that have dabbled in communism in the past. But at the same time, you can actually see when, you know, as I was talking about before, when communism is applied to local material conditions by non-European people, you can actually see that there is a way for it to work in a sustainable fashion. You know, look at what Thomas Sankara done in his 4 years of power in Burkina Faso. You know, he managed to prevent the massive desertification of Burkina Faso by implementing all of these programs to, you know, plant trees and to green spaces that were succumbing to the desert as a result of 200 plus years of European extraction in Africa. You know, this is a prime example. There are other examples as well across southern and central, you know, so-called America, where local indigenous people have taken back land, and they've done it through, you know, these, you know, frameworks that are adjacent to communism or anarchism or whatever else, but they've done it in a way that also incorporates their local knowledge, also incorporates their indigenous values and indigenous relationships with the land, and allows them to do it in a way where they can actually reverse quite a lot of the environmental collapse and destruction that has resulted from colonization. But we know that if we had a revolution here tomorrow in so-called Australia, and a bunch of settler Marxists or anarchists or whatever were to take power, that the ecological collapse and destruction of this continent would continue unchecked. You know, they might be able to mitigate some of it. You know, they might be able to reduce some of it, but they wouldn't be able to reverse it, and they definitely wouldn't be able to stop it either, let alone reverse it. So, you know, just something to consider as well when we look at the framework of liberalism and the way that it influences our ethics and our outlooks and the way that we define society and define stuff like progress.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.